Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
Since the beginning of the year, the world has been dealing with a global health crisis. But unfortunately, that is not the only crisis the world will be dealing with this year. By now it is clear, our economy will take a serious hit as well. Companies will go under, or else may become targets for mergers and acquisitions while in a weakened state. That also may have an impact on the data holdings of organizations. Can sets of customer, employee, and third-party data just be handed over from one company to the other, or sold to the highest bidder to return some money to investors? These are just some of the questions we will be talking about in today's episode of our podcast. My name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So today we are pleased to bring you Konstantin Karbliadis. And Konstantin, I will call you CK, and I probably brutalized your last name.
That's okay.
No, it's really not okay. I'm very particular with how people do my name. Quite often they misspell K, the biggest part being a period after it. Or they say Royale, which is also not correct. So I am very particular on names. So to get to business, so Konstantin is a privacy professional that's been in the field for, we were just talking about this, for a long time. And I've known him through various different places that he has worked. Paul, you've known him for a long time as well.
Yes, absolutely. Konstantin was my mentor at Nemity when I started there almost 4 years already, 4 years ago already. So yeah, we've worked together quite a lot.
So I also know that Konstantin, do you want me to call you Konstantin or CK? Because we all know what I usually call you, and I can't do that on this because I'm trying to avoid that. And for listeners, it's just a shortening of his real name, like a nickname, but nobody else calls him that.
CK is good because it abbreviates it. If you see me moving in front of a bus, I want you to use the shortest terminology necessary to get my attention. So that works.
So no Konstantin Karbaliotis, watch out.
No. I don't want you struggling.
Beautiful. We're going to put a link to his bio in the podcast so you can see how fantastic he is. But he's been with CGI. He's been with Symantec. He's been with Mercer. He's been with Nemity. He's been with PwC. He is now taking his own clients, which is fantastic. And yes, I'll give that plug there. So I'm sorry, I delayed in our podcast getting to the most important question, which is that unexpected personal question. And I've learned that Paul doesn't like me doing the this or that. So the question today is, how would you describe your victory dance?
My victory dance? Well, it's got a lot of Greek rhythms.
Ooh.
Think Zorba. And a glass of ouzo or Metaxa in hand. It always works too, so. That would be my victory dance. It's got that, you know, I hope that coolness to it, that cool Zorba coolness to it. But there you go.
Well, tell me the last time you did your victory dance. What was the situation?
Let's see. Well, you know, it's mostly family stuff. And so I guess that would probably be it. But, you know, in launching my practice, perhaps, you know, at the worst possible time, which we will talk about, I would say that I'm, you know, getting a good start to it, even despite the fact that, you know, all of this chaos is going on, which I guess goes to the point privacy is not sleeping, certainly even during, you know, COVID-19 or the economic fallout of it. So I guess I'm ready for that victory dance tonight, frankly.
Nice. Very nice. Paul, I'm going to you as to describe your victory dance, and when was the last time you had the opportunity to dance victoriously?
I think the victory dance would involve a lot of waving of arms above my head. I don't assume or presume to have any kind of coolness in my victory dance. Mm-hmm. When was the last time I used it? Probably when I got some good news from the university about new things that we're going to do that I can't talk about yet.
Ooh, mystery. I love it.
Just to tease us.
And well,
I'm sure we'll have opportunity in future episodes to discuss it, but not yet.
I'm going to hold you to it, put you on a timeline.
So what about your dance?
I'm going to go with y'all. Mine is also not very cool.
Uh-huh.
But it has arms waving to the side, not waving above my head. And I would have to...
A bit like the Fortnite dance?
There you go.
Oh, no. That's the opposite of cool. I'm sorry.
Oh, wait. Maybe not. Maybe I need to look up Fortnite dance before I talk about this.
Yes, please.
So I do have a more discreet one I use in public. And yes, I've done my victory dance in public. But the last time I can actually recall using it was when I met Ann Cavoukian.
That's pretty cool.
She actually came and talked to the privacy class that I was teaching. So that was really cool. And as soon as I escorted her to the ladies' room, I did a victory dance outside her vision. Okay, enough personal talk about that. She probably has no idea I did that. She probably doesn't need to know. So with that, Paul, let's get on to something more serious.
So, yeah, moving on to some more serious topics and some... quite serious topics, I should say. Constantine, when we started discussing you coming on as a guest, you had a whole series of topics that you wanted to speak about. And given that we only have about 45 minutes for this whole conversation, we cannot do the whole laundry list of topics that you came up with. But let's start with mergers and acquisitions, and then move on to bankruptcy. But mergers and acquisitions is... I would say a very important topic from a privacy perspective. It is also a topic that people might not be as aware of and might not be thinking about as much when dealing with privacy and data protection issues. Why is this a topic that you really wanted to discuss?
Well, and I'll say I think that there's going to be a strong connection with a second grouping, which is the bankruptcy and insolvency situation, because I think if you lump them together, what we're going to be looking at for the next while is a period of reorganization, and it's going to happen in a number of different forms. But the M&A area has always been interesting, having been involved in a number of them in my previous roles. And looking at it from the point of view of, well, you know, as you would in any M&A discussion, what kind of risks are we taking on? What can we mitigate during the evaluation process? What needs to be done then afterwards? So this is something that people in the M&A area are used to dealing with in a variety of different compliance contexts, but haven't thought through typically in relation to, you know, how... personal information factors in. And it's strange, in my view, because when you look at the value of most organizations today, it's not in the bricks and mortar, it's in the data. And, you know, if they're actually interested in, you know, an acquisition, it's typically because of its clients and consumers, the people who constitute really the value to the organization and the relationships they hold with it. So, as I say, I've always found it strange that there's not been a bigger focus on it because that is, of course, a significant element of the value. And we've also now seen, you know, a number of instances where the value of the target has been seriously impacted because of privacy issues, or that there have been outcomes for the acquirer in not doing its due diligence properly.
So I guess you are referring here to cases from Marriott and also from Yahoo and the Verizon takeover?
Absolutely. You put your finger right on the main sort of use cases, which I've used to communicate the importance of bringing privacy people into M&A discussions early on. You know, in
you mean before you actually buy the company and get data you shouldn't have, and then you look at the privacy person and say, hey, what do we do with this?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, a story I've often liked to use in the privacy context is about a fellow who's had a bad day and decides to take a drive, you know, and is relaxing as he's driving through, you know, winding hills in his convertible. And a car goes in the other direction and a woman sticks out her head and yells pig as she goes by. And the guy gets mad again and goes, why did she call me that? She doesn't even know me. He puts his foot on the accelerator and of course then goes around the next curve and runs smack into a pig. So we're kind of like those people trying to keep them from, you know, creating bacon on the road. And it's, you know, they often don't want to hear at times because everyone typically gets very excited about the acquisition and what it means, you know, and we're there sort of trying to put the brakes on things, no pun intended, to make sure that we don't have a problem later on. So there's two ways to break down this problem. And the way I developed a PIA, you know, rinse, repeat. We know PIAs work. They're a great way to understand and mitigate risk. And so I developed a two-part PIA in order to address this. First, let's look at the transaction itself, because often we're looking at either employee or customer's data. And we have to think about how it's being protected. Do we have, in fact, the right to look at it? If you're bringing data from Europe elsewhere, is it being brought, you know, to, for instance, the U.S., you know, under the privacy shield or model clauses, even the transactional elements of it to make sure that it's secured? I mean, you always concern yourself with confidentiality because, of course, you don't want insider trading or other activities going on that are not good. But you have to be particularly careful to make sure that the data itself is protected. As it's being looked at and evaluated in terms of, you know, the main transaction. And then there's the second part, which is, what are we actually buying in terms of liability? Have they had incidents, complaints to a regulator? Have they actually gotten consent before they got all that lovely data? Because transaction, you know, typically an acquisition, can call a lot of attention to the practices of the target organization and, you know, may draw more attention from regulators, may result in access or other inquiries from consumers. So you've got to be very careful to know the provenance of the data to make sure that what you're acquiring is actually the value that it's being presented at. And so really the PIA is in two parts. We look at the transaction and we look what we're acquiring and the consequences of acquiring. And one organization I worked for, we were under GLBA and therefore could not leverage, in those days, Safe Harbor. And the acquisition, the target, was under Safe Harbor. You had to now contemplate delisting. All right. So there are, you know, potentially big consequences and tasks that need to be addressed in what you're changing by bringing this organization now into a larger context, even where you may have overlap in the data between the individuals that you may currently have and that exist in the target. If you consolidate that data, now you have an entirely different vision or view of those individuals and can create a whole new set of risks. And maybe were not actually contemplated when either of the two organizations got the data under the consents they may have. So these are just some examples of the kinds of issues that I've contended with.
There's also quite a lot of criticism from regulators, especially here in Europe, on companies not doing enough due diligence in times of mergers and acquisitions. If you look at the Marriott case, the Information Commissioner's Office in the United Kingdom states in their press release from last year, it is believed the vulnerability began when the systems of the Starwood Hotels Group were compromised in 2014. Marriott subsequently acquired Starwood in 2016, but the exposure of customer information was not discovered until 2018. The ICO's investigation found that Marriott failed to undertake sufficient due diligence when it bought Starwood and should also have done more to secure its systems. European Data Protection Board in cases of Apple buying Shazam and Google buying Fitbit has also heavily criticized both companies, pointing them to their obligations under the GDPR, including the need to conduct in a transparent way a full assessment of the data protection requirements and privacy implications of the merger. So two regulators in very clear terms stating that companies should indeed do that PIA that you were talking about, should include privacy and data protection as part of their due diligence.
And in that particular case, I mean, it's a very good example and a real clear message about the duty to do that due diligence, not only to your shareholders, but in order to look at the real risks associated with, you know, the target company and actually fix them. You know, you acquire all the liabilities that go along with handling that data. And I think that's the key message here, is that there's, no sort of forgiveness of past history that's possible. You are buying the liabilities along with the assets.
So what about the information provision to individuals?
Well, you know, you have, of course, big challenges in, it's like when you talk about it from a data subject access request standpoint, what you may find is that the target company doesn't really understand, as many organizations don't, their flows of data, who's got access to it, and so on. So this is going to present a significant workload to the privacy office of the acquiring organization to now encompass that, be able to respond. And one has to be aware that there are requirements, as there is, for instance, in Canada, to give individuals the ability to withdraw their information after the fact. So you've got to look at the different jurisdictions in which you're operating and see what are the obligations that may be triggered when this acquisition takes place, not just from a data subject access request, but indeed from the ability to withdraw consent altogether.
Hey, any questions you have on this?
No, M&A happens to be a very, well, I mean, we've already said that, a very complicated process, especially when you add privacy in the mix. I think back over some of the companies I've worked with and some of the clients I've worked with as a consultant, and quite often, and I made the facetious comment earlier about not involving the privacy officer, but they often don't. And so you wind up inheriting a lot of privacy issues or privacy things that went wrong because they didn't involve the privacy officer early enough. And in one case, they actually let the privacy officer of the company go before they brought in the privacy officer of their own company. And, you know, she would have preferred to have kept that privacy officer because it was in a different region with lots of different laws. So I think just being aware of the fact that M&A requires a lot of issues when it comes to privacy. And the best thing is just to make sure that you include your privacy people in the conversation. And if you're a privacy person and you don't know a lot about mergers and acquisitions, then I would say learn.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think you brought up a really good point, which is not to cast away skills. I mean, one of the things that everyone gets excited about in mergers and acquisitions and seeing the value of it is consolidation and reducing the number of what they consider to be, you know, non-essential staff. And I really don't think that's a good perspective on privacy, because the relationships, particularly that people may have in, you know, for instance, in Europe, and the knowledge they have of the particular rules there, means that you may, you know, be casting away some really, really important knowledge and connections by saying, well, I don't need that many privacy people. Mm-hmm. If that's right. You know, your only criteria, it really should be a risk-based decision. And a value.
Well, and it should really involve your own privacy people.
Well, exactly. And I suspect that many of them would say, heck no, I don't want to lose that person.
Right.
Because,
but at least let there be some transition time.
Well, yes, at least. But, you know, again, as we know, most privacy offices are understaffed. So it's probably an ad that people would want to keep, frankly, you know.
Exactly. But even a 90-day transition time would be fantastic to get the person up to speed. Are there any issues going on? Anything like that. The other part that I see often, and I believe a company got reprimanded for this, and I'll see if I can't find the story on it. But in privacy notices, companies say we, you know, have the right to transfer your data if we are acquired by another company, or if we are being, what do you call it, split off. And the company did that, but they shared the data before the effective date of the merger.
Yeah.
Oops.
Or the acquisition. Contracts had already been signed. The it had already been approved, gone through all the legal notices. Just there was an effective date. And I believe the data was shared like a week before the effective date because, hey, all the contracts are signed. We can do this. And so I believe that they were reprimanded by the regulators for taking that action against their own privacy commitments.
Right. I mean, you know, these words mean something.
Right.
You make, you know.
And so do dates.
Yeah. You know, you've made commitments, you know, honor them. I mean, I think that that's the gist of a lot of decisions that are coming out of, you know, the data protection authorities, like know what grounds, in fact, that you're processing data on. You know, these things matter. There's not just simply formalities.
Right.
So I think that. Regarding privacy as a formality is the underlying issue
right.
there. And I think that that's where people are going to continue to be caught out. So I do believe that, you put your finger on a very important, you know, sort of psychological component of this, which is the thing we all struggle with. How do we make this important for the people running the M&A to, you know, like get us involved? And I would say I was quite lucky that the people that I was working with typically did understand that I was adding a value to their risk mitigation in the exercise.
Shocker.
Yeah. I mean, it you know, they saw this, certainly understood it from a security standpoint. That's almost a given these days. But I think that even I was lucky in that early on, they recognized, you know, there is value in this data. Let's make sure that we're not buying a bunch of liability along with it.
Right.
So,
and I,
yeah.
This comes back to something that is one of the things I live by. I believe that calling it privacy or data protection puts an automatic block in people's mind because they presuppose they know what it means. Instead, if people thought of it as managing personal data, they might actually bring the right people in at the right time.
Yeah. I think we go back to the heart of, you know, where I started, which is recognizing that personal data is a significant asset, as well as being imbued with obligations, legal obligations, with it being a human right. In companies' hands, this is an asset. And curiously, we don't
right.
seem to treat it like one. It's just a bunch of electrons. And that's, I think, the flawed thinking that we're going to have to really reevaluate. And I think that, you know, again, the decision in relation to Marriott makes it very clear. This is, you know, imbued with obligations you cannot neglect. And you need to do appropriate due diligence, not just for your shareholders, but as your duty under privacy laws. So, you know, so there,
right.
it's got that dual, you know, sort of component. It's both carrot and stick.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. And that segues well when you think of thinking of personal data as an asset
mm-hmm.
into bankruptcy. And yes,
yes,
I'm hurrying you through this because I really, really, really want to ask you about the CCPA. So,
well, we'll talk about bankruptcy first.
Yeah.
So are we just selling data to the highest bidder following bankruptcy?
Well, you know, unfortunately, that's the duty of a trustee in bankruptcy, as we refer to it, to do, is to regain whatever value, first of all, for creditors and then for shareholders that can be obtained. The challenge, of course, is if they don't have an understanding of what it means, if they look at this as simply a list, and, you know, so there's two areas of risk. I mean, certainly the party that acts, and it's typically a private sector organization, even though it's operating under the authority of a statute, has to and undergo some due diligence to make sure that there's actually some value there, that it's not, again, imbued with all sorts of issues. Because the other side is that the purchaser is going to look, again, at the provenance of that data and say, am I buying something that's real or am I buying a liability? And so, all the same issues we talked about in the context of mergers and acquisitions apply here as well. You know, you can buy nothing of value or you can buy something of value. And it becomes then a dual responsibility to make sure that some issues have been remediated. And I think it's often beyond the capacity of many of the industry that's associated with bankruptcy and insolvency to actually undertake the steps necessary to make sure that the data itself is has value. Because if, you know, consent has been properly obtained but not documented, it all brings out a host of programmatic problems that have existed in the past, right? They will mm-hmm. become clear where things have not been done properly, because it may mean that, you know, if, again, you know, they may have obtained consent, but if they haven't recorded it properly, they've got nothing to sell.
No, that's true. And at the same time, consent is not always the good legal basis. From the EU perspective, from the GDPR perspective, I do think there is quite a difference between bankruptcy on the one hand and M&A processes on the other side. Because especially in bankruptcy, before you can reuse the data, you have to do a whole series of assessments, apart mm-hmm. from, yeah. of course, the impact assessment that you referred to before. But for example, you can never just sell the data or reuse the data as mm-hmm. a new company based on compatible use, because by definition, it would not be compatible use. Mm-hmm. So if the data set is just sold off to gain money, this can only be done on the basis of consent, at least per the guidance yeah. of the Dutch Data Protection Authority. And then you need every single person's consent, which may be very difficult to obtain. Only if the third party is continuing to provide a contracted service, for example, mm-hmm. Then the personal data could be transferred on the basis of the performance of the contract, because then the contract will continue, but just with a new supplier. So that is something to bear in mind from the GDPR perspective. You really need to look at whether you have a legal basis to sell off the data, and the trustee then becomes the acting data controller with a need to ensure that data protection law is complied with.
Well, let's build on that a little bit, Paul. What about the legitimate basis or the legal basis of legitimate interest? So, of course, I have my thoughts on whether or not if one company acquires another, if company one acquires company two, does company one have a legitimate interest in company two's data?
Nope.
You could have at least pretended to take a thought about it.
If company one is assuming, for instance, the employment relationships with individuals and continuing to provide, you know, committed benefits and so on, does that change the picture?
No, it doesn't, because legitimate interest is a ground to process personal data you collect for a single purpose mm-hmm. in the first place. Mm-hmm. That does not automatically include the transmission of that data to a third party, because transmission is a different purpose than the collection in the mm-hmm. first place. So mm-hmm. even in terms of in times of bankruptcy, it would very likely be a change of purpose and thus no compatible continued use. So that legitimate interest is never a ground just for the transfer mm-hmm. of data to a third party.
So in assuming, for instance, employees, you would have to address that in whatever documentation you're also providing, you're also dealing with that transmission.
Yes, and for the employees, I think it would be then you could base it on performance of a contract mm-hmm. because then the new company,
right?
Yeah,
legal obligation
would not a legal obligation, because that's something stipulated by law, a contractual obligation, because then the employment contract will be carried on to a new employer who will then need the relevant data to mm-hmm. Continue to serve the employee employment agreement. but also only the relevant information for the provision of that contract.
But isn't it a legal obligation to actually pay the people who work for you?
Well, that's true, but you know what's happening.
You have volunteers.
What's happening in the case of a bankruptcy is that your obligations are terminating, right? I mean, it may depend on how the acquisition if it becomes an acquisition, like if we go back to the first case, then you may have a stronger basis for saying, well, I'm just simply assuming the responsibilities of the previous company, or I'm acquiring the company and doing it in that context. If it's a bankruptcy, it's a whole new employer. So you're forming a new relationship.
Right.
So I do think the structure of the transaction matters in that situation. And that may be something also to think about when organizations are looking at, as they inevitably will be in the next little while, as I said, lots of reorganization, consolidation taking place, how the transaction is being done and structured will make a difference in terms of how you're going to actually make sure that the data gets from point A to point B.
So, Constantine, you have always been lucky enough to deal with a lot of privacy contracts as well. And I know this is something you love dearly, drawing up contracts and negotiating them. Are there any specific provisions that you would include in a contract to deal with situations like bankruptcy? For example, in processing agreements, that data could be returned in case of bankruptcy instead of being sold off?
Well, always it's best to do these things before anything bad has happened. That's the, of course, killer sort of point, because no one ever actually thinks about these things until the bad thing happens. So if you can address these in notices, into your consumers or in your employment contracts in advance, then, you have anticipated potential changes that would allow, at least some more relative smoothness in these kinds of, transactions and transitions that companies will be undergoing. So I do think that, the further out you can get with these things, before anybody is facing these kinds of issues. And you do see some language in agreements and in contracts and notices dealing with, the happy case of being acquired, but not so often with the more negative one of what happens if things should go wrong. No one wants to think about it. No one wants to buy life insurance. So why would they want to do this? No one gets out alive. But the point, I guess, is that, it becomes a challenge for the lawyers involved in these transactions, because in order to do their due diligence, they have to do a risk assessment in order to inform what needs to be there in terms of contractual terms, in terms of indemnities, in terms of warranties that you might be getting from the parties who are selling. It also may mean sometimes fundamentally reevaluating, as I said, the value of what you're acquiring, because it may be too late to fix some of these issues. Holdbacks, obviously critical in this. I mean, I think that the lessons of, Yahoo and Marriott are probably good to, point out in this context, because sometimes you won't know for a while about issues that have arisen, arose in the past. Hopefully, in your due diligence, you've uncovered them, right? I mean, I think that's part of the criticism is, in the Marriott case, is this should have been uncovered. If it was uncovered, why wasn't it addressed? So I do think that there is definitely a tie-in that lawyers have to play in thinking about how the privacy impact assessment component of the exercise of due diligence should inform the contractual terms, because it's obviously the risk management elements of contract that we're focused on.
Let's hope that people start to become much more aware that that is indeed relevant and that they should act now instead of when it is too late. And now, Kay, you already alluded to it. You would like the Canadian perspective on the California law, right?
I would love that, because I mean, let me see if I can hold back my enthusiasm here.
Right.
Yeah. So the California Attorney General has filed the final rulemaking proposals to the, what do they call it? The California Office of Administrative Law. And they have 30 days, apparently, plus an additional 60 calendar days related to the COVID-19 pandemic to review the regulations to see if they're in compliance with the Administrative Procedure Act. And then we're going to have some regulations for California. Now, the Attorney General has already filed a petition asking for an expedited review, basically to get rid of that additional 60 calendar days under COVID-19. So he really wants these approved fast. We have been waiting a long time for these regulations to come out. Most people may recall that the CCPA has a provision that it would go into enforcement either on July 1st of 2020, so we're less than a month away from that, or 6 months after the regulations were adopted, whichever came first. Well, we don't even have regulations adopted. Are published yet, but I believe the California Attorney General is still public with his perspective that enforcement will start on July 1st. So I'm not going to ask about your specific feelings about the regulations themselves. Let's talk about the CCPA just from a Canadian perspective. I mean, Europeans in general seem to kind of like the CCPA. It looks like, you know, America is getting some stronger privacy laws. Maybe this will drive some additional states to pass privacy laws. What's your perspective?
Well, I mean, first of all, we're probably a little bit jealous would be a fair way to describe it, because we've been waiting for some time for our legislation to be updated. And I think that before the COVID crisis, there was some optimism that even in late spring or early fall, that updates to our federal law, PIPEDA, the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act, would be tabled in Parliament.
Oh, so you say it PIPEDA.
PIPEDA, because all privacy laws in Canada have to go with the last name Longstocking. PIPA, FIPA, PIPEDA. You see. All have to be young girls' names. So the point is that we've been waiting for some time for our legislation to be updated. There is a very serious consciousness of the fact that we're going to have our friends in Europe knocking on our door at some point asking for us to update our legislation, because we would like to retain our adequacy with the European Union. And, you know, that is important. That is facilitating, you know, importantly, trade and commerce with the European Union. But also we want and need updated legislation. So when the Americans start passing privacy laws, well, it makes it a little bit harder to say we shouldn't be. And, you know, And that also is driving, you know, one of the principal impacts of GDPR and now CCPA on Canadian companies is because so much of our economy is based on trade. We're having the application of these laws coming through contract. There's contract again. So because, you know, if, you know, a large company, U.S. company that operates in Europe and in the United States starts writing letters saying, please show how you're GDPR and CCPA compliant, suddenly, you know, revenue is attached to this. And that's a really powerful motivator for people to do privacy, much more so than just the stick part of it. There is the carrot for you. So it is motivating.
Yeah, if the law doesn't get you, the clients will.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, so Canadian companies are now, you know, being motivated, and I think very powerfully. I think it also is going to create for us legislatively, there's an erosion effect when you see all these jurisdictions, particularly U.S. jurisdictions, introducing privacy laws, that it's not so hard then to, you know, given that there's often business pushback, to say, well, you know, we're just keeping up. So I think it will have a positive impact on us because it's going to create, again, that has that erosive effect. It's going to drive it through trade. We have the same practical considerations that many U.S. companies are facing. Why would we do something different for Californians? You know, and then have another, you know, set of processes and rules for people in the rest of the union. We'll just deal with everybody the same way. So it increasingly becomes a floor where you have to sort of treat everybody in pretty much the same fashion. Now, we've always had rights under our federal law to access, to correction, we do have a little bit of our own patchwork because of our federal provincial distinction, in laws. And, you know, only three Canadian provinces have their own broad private sector privacy laws, though we do have a number of provinces have health sector laws. But the health stuff is really important. Because of COVID-19, I think that there's, a driver, and I think this goes to the heart of why this regulation process in California is not going to probably be deferred, is, and this may be an observation that's global, COVID-19 has really put privacy, I think, at front and center for a lot of the public. Because of contact tracing conversations that are taking place, they're much more conscious of the gathering. Everyone seems to have a much greater willingness to understand privacy when it's in the context of their personal health information for some reason. And right. That's going to, I think, also create a driver for not just is a driver for, potentially for this regulation to be done in a shorter period of time, but also is going to be for us a factor in perhaps even bringing our laws back onto the front burner, our update, again, due to the fact that we're seeing so much participation between public health authorities and the private sector in trying to manage this crisis.
How do you feel about private right of action? Maybe this is a question I shouldn't ask, but I've been in a lot of debates on U.S. law recently. And
dive in.
This is the topic that always seems up somehow.
Canada sits somewhere between Europe and the United States in this, and we're not quite as litigious as the Americans, at the same time, we do have class actions that are proceeding because of large breaches in Canada, but they're just not as commonplace, and they don't tend to get the same kind of awards. And we're a bit more conservative in this regard. But I think that, there's always been this, struggle to see how, if you don't have a strong central body enforcing privacy rules, then there's a tendency to look to the private bar to, in effect, do that. And it does. I think there is a balancing act that has to take place because not everything, needs to be litigated nor should be litigated. At the same time, we do know that it motivates companies to actually, do things, sometimes essential things. So we've never been quite so focused on the private right of action being baked into our laws. Our debate has been largely around what kind of enforcement power should be given to the privacy commissioner. But I do recognize that there is a value to this, because the correspondingly, if you're going to give the regulator that responsibility, you have to equip them to actually carry it out. And I think that's been perhaps one of the challenges that the European regulators have faced. They've been given a tremendous responsibility, and have they got the resources to keep up with that?
So I know that we are coming closer to the end of our time. When we asked you to come on the podcast episode, and you have experience in so many different areas, was there one thing in particular you were hoping that you could say to all of our thousands and thousands of listeners out there, if there was one thing you wanted to make sure that you could share?
Well, it's an observation I've shared before in other conversations, and it's that what COVID-19, really means is it's a big reset. It's really going to cause us to rethink not only the way we work and, of course, working from home and doing things virtually. And it could be very positive in many respects. But what this is also going to do is really stress test not only business resiliency, but also the quality of the privacy programs that are in place. We're going to see, I suspect, over the next 24 months, a lot of outcomes from decisions that are being made right now. Simple one example would be, how long are we going to keep the temperature information of our employees? You don't have a good handle on your retention now. you're just going to compound it with all of that juicy, sensitive data that you now have got. If you don't have a notion of how you're going to, you've been limiting sharing, it's just going to become all the more obvious. So if there's anything that I would say to particularly the privacy audiences, this is going to be a time where really that stress test is going to show the fractures, show the weaknesses in privacy programs, and we should be seizing the opportunity to fix them once and for all, so that they do present the kind of resiliency that we look for in right now in other areas of work and life, so that we can do the right thing even through crises.
That's great.
I love it.
Thank you very much, Constantine. And that concludes another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please subscribe in your favorite podcast app, and do tell your friends and colleagues about us as well. We love more listeners, even though the numbers are really spiking already. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter at podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy. Until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.